So we just want to, you know, to say, how do we prepare ourselves, prepare our hearts? And so we're going to do this series. We're only a couple of weeks out, but maybe it's part of helping prepare for Easter. Now, you don't want to walk into Easter and say, okay, it's going to be the most exceptional thing ever. It's going to be the highest emotional experience I've ever had. You just set yourself up for disappointment, right? But you say, I would like it to be meaningful. I'd like my heart to be there. So we're going to do this series, and kind of the theme of it's going to be, I am. It's going to be based around some of the statements that Jesus made about the I ams. And he said a bunch of them. But we've selected just a few, and we're going to kind of walk through those. It's kind of the focus of our Easter series. And just so you know, next week, which is Palm Sunday, it's going to be I am the suffering servant. We're going to talk about that in a unique way that connected to Palm Sunday. Then on Good Friday, it's going to be I am the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. We're going to talk about that. And then on Easter, understandably, we're going to talk about when Jesus says, I am the resurrection, and what that meant and how it fit into the whole story. And so we're going to talk about that. And then today, though, we're going to talk about I am the way, the truth, and the life. Okay? Now, just so you know, here's the big idea for today. Here's kind of the big thing. Understanding the nature and the character of God is the beginning and the understanding of life. Now, I recognize when we say that, that just kind of feels like blah, 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 right? In a sense, that understanding the nature and the character of God is actually the beginning and the understanding of life itself. Now, let's take it out of the blah, 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 okay? Just kind of like religious words. Let me ask a question. What does our culture do with God today? Really? You know, it's out there. Obviously, every culture, every person, eventually the word God crosses their lips in some way, shape, or form, or crosses our mind, or we begin to think about it. But in a culture where it's become blah, 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 what do we do with it? Let me just throw out, and there's a bunch of things we do with this issue of God. But let me just throw out a few. First of all, we deny, right? We deny. Say, I don't buy it. I'm not into it. I don't think it's real. Here's a quote from Stephen Hawking, the famous physicist who's passed away recently. He said this, when people ask me if a God created the universe, I tell them that the question itself makes no sense. Time doesn't exist before the Big Bang, so there is no time for God to make the universe. So he's saying that God could only exist inside of time and space, and since there was no time and space before the Big Bang, the question itself is ridiculous. He goes on and he says, it's like asking directions to the edge of the earth. The earth is a sphere. It doesn't have an edge. So looking for it is a futile exercise. We are each free to believe what we want, but in my view, that the simplest explanation is there is no God. No one created the universe and no one creates our fate. It leads me to a profound realization that there is probably no heaven and no afterlife either. We have this one life to appreciate the grand design of the universe. Really, a grand design of the universe? But there's no one who created it, and there's no one. It's an interesting conflict in his statement here, right? But that there's to appreciate the grand design of the universe, and for that I am extremely grateful. He was grateful for the life that he had here. But there is no design to it, no one who guides it, no one who designed it, though his own statement contradicts that. But there's a deny. Probably a lot of people, a lot of us probably live in denial of thinking about it. There's another way we can deal with, you know, how does our culture deal with God? It is to dismiss it. Dismiss God. Just kind of say, I don't know, doesn't make sense to me or doesn't know where it fits. In fact, Bill Gates said this in his interview with the Rolling Stone magazine. He said, I think it makes sense to believe in God, but exactly what decision in your life you make differently because of it, I don't know. So he dismisses it. This is years ago. I would wonder if today he's answering that question differently. After a failed marriage, after implication with the sex scandal with Jeffrey Epstein, his life is now in a very different place. And you wonder if he deep down is beginning to say, maybe God does make a difference. And he doesn't just dismiss it any longer. And I don't want to pick on Bill Gates. We've all been there, right? How about maybe diminish God? We just diminish him. Let's make him small. let's take certain parts of the scriptures or certain parts of who he is or at least claims to be, and let's diminish it. Let's make it smaller. Let's make it less significant. I think Woody Allen, the commentator of my generation, said this: if it turns out that there is a God, the worst that you can say about him is that basically he's an underachiever. That's what he said. Let's diminish him. He's an underachiever in all of this. If he's a God, then the world's a mess and everything's a joke, and he pretty much screwed up. He's an underachiever. Maybe another way to look at God is to simply degrade him. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the physicist and social commentator, what he does, he said this: God is an ever-receding pocket of scientific ignorance. Let's degrade him. God is an ignorant presence and intelligence in the world, right? Or maybe we go even from there to demote. Let's just demote God. Seems like what our culture deals with God. And a guy named Scott Dykens says this. Dykers says he's really a comedian, but he makes little pokes at the culture. And he says this: be sure to lie to your kids about the benevolent, all-seeing Santa Claus. It will prepare them for an adulthood of believing in God. It just demotes God, right, to this flippy-dippy Santa Claus idea. Wow, what do we do with God? What do we do with him? Now, let me go back to the big idea here. Let's circle it. Let's kind of highlight it. Understanding the nature and the character of God is the beginning and understanding of life. And maybe it's not so blah, 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 because there are people who are making comment about it, whether it be to deny or dismiss or diminish or degrade or demote God. What do we do with him? Who is he? What is he like? Does it matter? Does it engage our lives? And in this season of us talking about Easter, that we celebrate that Jesus died and rose again, and it makes a total difference, are we just kind of preaching to ourselves? Are we just having a nice real little religious tea party here? And the rest of the world says you're a joke. Or is there something significant going on? I think that's the question for today. So in order to engage that, we're going to get to the New Testament, but I'd like to start in the Old Testament. I think at a really critical point in the redemptive history that God has unfolded along the way, and it's going to do it in the life of Moses. So let's go to Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. And we're going to go there. Let's start with verses 1 through 6. It says, "Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness, and he came to Horeb, the mountain of God." Now let's just stop for a second. Who's this guy named Moses? So Moses is a Hebrew. And he has been with all of Israel. He finds himself in Egypt. He's born there, and they start to say, "Hey, we're going to kill all the Hebrew babies." And so his mom puts him in a basket and puts him out in the River Nile, wanting to save his life and hoping that something positive happens. And Pharaoh's daughter finds this, and he says, and she's like, "Wow!" And she raises this kid, and she raises him in Pharaoh's house. He grows up in great privilege. He grew up for the first 40 years of his life thinking he was absolutely incredibly somebody important. But when he was 40 years old, he knew he was a Hebrew. But when he was 40, he saw a Hebrew gentleman being abused by an Egyptian. And it made him mad. And so he killed the Egyptian. And he hid his body. And he was found out. And he escaped. He ran away. And he spent the next 40 years in a desert, basically, and he finds a wife there, and he grows, and he has a family, and he's living life. And for those 40 years, he thinks he's absolutely nobody of great importance. Now, the last 40 years of Moses' life, he's going to find out, and he gets to see what God can do with anybody. But he spent 40 years thinking he was somebody, 40 years thinking he was nobody, and 40 years finding out that God can do something significant with anybody. But here we are at the end of those 40 years out in the desert. And so he's keeping flock. He's watching the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness. So he's out in the Sinai, incredibly desolate place, and he comes to Horeb, which is called the Mountain of God. Now let's stop just for a second. Here we find the name of God mentioned. So he says God, right? You know, really, is this a God to deny, dismiss, diminish, demote, degrade? Or something's going on here, and Moses is going to clue in. So the word here for God is Elohim. It means God. That's kind of the biggest, in a sense, the translation we always use in the Old Testament. It means God. And here's the deal. It's over 2,500 times the word Elohim is used in the Old Testament. It's a plural noun. Interesting that it's plural. In fact, El, the first part of the name, circle it, means God. So if you have Israel, it ends in E-L. It means God. And the last two letters of his name, of Elohim, I-M, is plural. Interesting. So it's a plural noun, and it's usually used with a singular verb. There's a tension there. They should match normally, but they don't. This plurality in his name is usually understood as the plurality of what we call majesty, or the plurality of honor, or the plurality of excellence. That this God is so majestic and so huge and so powerful that the name is actually plural. Now, there are others who would suggest that this plurality, it becomes what opens up to what could be the Trinity of God the Father and God the Son and God the Holy Spirit. And because when we're made in his image, it says, let us make mankind in our image, plural. That maybe the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are all involved in the creation of man, because that's where we get it from. In fact, we have a sense of the powerfulness of God with Elohim. Okay, in Genesis 1:1, it says, in the beginning, God, Elohim, created the heavens and the earth. So there's this concept of God, that he is the creator. He is the powerful one. He is the one who's done all of this. Elohim. It's a great name, right? It's a great word. It's worth grabbing onto and using. That the God who created us is the incredible Elohim. That's how he's presented here. Now, let's go to verse 2. It says, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. Now let's just stop for a second. The angel of the Lord changes a little bit of words, right? Lord rather than God. This is the word Yahweh. It's always translated in the Old Testament for English, Lord rather than God. It means Lord. It's this. It is the proper name of the God of Israel. Okay? So in a sense, here's what it says. The powerful Elohim is seen as the sovereign God over the nation Israel. It's in a sense, this God of all of creation in heaven takes one step down and says, I am the sovereign God over all of Israel. And the Jews really, and the Israelites, the Hebrews, they grabbed onto this. But this name is so powerful, so amazing, that they don't even, it is so holy that they won't even say it. They won't even say the name Yahweh. And so they'll find other names to say, like Adonai, or others, because it is so holy, it cannot pass their lips. Now, it's interesting, there are no vowels in Hebrew. Just so you know, in the original Hebrew, there are no vowels. It's all consonants. And then you're just to sort of understand where the vowels were. But with time, people forgot. And so they began to add these little markings in Hebrew to kind of tell you what vowel you might want to use in all of it. Now, just so you know, here's the Hebrew word for Yahweh. It's called the Tetragrammaton. So it's kind of a cool name. Just grab onto that, Tetragrammaton. You're like, hey, I really learned something today. And Hebrew reads from right to left, right? So it's totally confusing. When I took Hebrew, I was like lost the entire time. You go from right to left. Even as they read a sentence, it goes from right to left. Thank goodness it does go from top of the page to the bottom of the page. That's the only redeeming factor for me. But so you go right to left. And so here are the four letters. It goes Yod, He, Wah, He. It's all consonants. You're like, oh, I wonder what the vowels are. And so they think the vowels possibly would be, and let's put just down the first letter down here for each of those letters. And they add a couple of vowels, hoping that they're the right vowels. And so there's an A and an E in a sense. Now let's squeeze those together. Here's what it looks like backwards. And now let's put it front way so that we in the English world, it's Yahweh. And this Yahweh is the sovereign God of Israel. He takes a step down, or in a sense closer to mankind, to say, I am the sovereign God over you. This is the God that Abraham engaged. You know, it was Elohim, but he says, I want to bless you so you can bless the nations. I want to use you as a people, Abraham, and all of your descendants, who are going to be more than the sands of the sea. The numbers are going to be incredible. I want to use you to bless the world. The sovereign God, Yahweh, is in this. Now, so, verse 2, and the angel of the Lord, Yahweh, appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And Moses looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And you can think Moses is saying, okay, something's weird's going on here. This is a little different. So he engages it, and Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see. The Lord, Yahweh, saw that he had turned aside to see, and God, Elohim, called him out of the bush. Moses, Moses, and he said, here I am. Grab onto that. Here I am. I'm just here. Like I've been doing the sheep thing, and I'm, here I am. Okay, and God goes, great, man, it's exactly where I need you. So it goes on. And then he said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. You are engaging the God Elohim. You are engaging the God Yahweh. And now he's going to give him something else here. And he says, and he said, I am the God, this is Elohim of your father, the one who created them. I am the God Elohim of Abraham. I am the God Elohim of Isaac, and I am the God Elohim of Isaac, of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at Elohim. He all suddenly understood, oh my gosh, this is a holy place. The one who created all of my forefathers, the one I've heard all these stories about, the one that I've heard about all that God has done and brought us here. I'm afraid to look. Wow. Look at verse 7. And then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people. And Yahweh. I have seen the affliction of my people. I am the sovereign God of Israel. I've seen you. I understand it. I'm engaging. I know what you're going through. I know that you've been afflicted. You guys, the God Yahweh understands where you're at too. He understands what's going on, the affliction that you're going through, the difficulty, the challenge, the hurt, the pain, the confusion. When you feel like life is getting way past you or all the way around you and you don't know how to grab onto it. When you feel that desperate I don't know if you ever feel it, that desperate place in your heart. You despair. You're confused. And you go, God, where are you? Man, I need you. Yahweh is there. And he's there for him. He says, I understand the affliction you're going through, and I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their suffering, and I've come down to deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of the land into a good and broad place, a land flowing with milk and honey, a place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Where they live, I'm taking you there. It's an incredible place. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come up to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Wow! Here's a guy who thought he was nobody. God says, I want to use you. I want to use you to go do something incredible. I want to have you do something to help these people who are in such oppression. Wow, that's incredible. But Moses said to God, he said to Elohim, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Now, on a human level, you'd say, well, Moses, who better? Who better? I mean, you grew up in all that whole thing. You get it. You know Pharaoh. You know how it functions. And he goes, yeah, but I ran away. I ran away 40 years ago. I murdered someone and I ran away. Can't you find someone better? Who am I? You guys grab onto that. Who am I? At first he says, I am, here I am. And then he goes, oh, wait a second. Who am I? I'm like, maybe I shouldn't be here. This isn't where I should be. Verse 12, and he said, but I will be, grab onto that, I will be with you. And this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you, that when you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. I'm going to bring you back here. I know it's lonely right now. It's just a little burning bush, but I'm bringing you back here. And you're going to bring all those people with you. It'll be a sign. Just remember, you're coming back. Now, let's go on to verse 13. And Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers, the Elohim of your fathers, right, has sent me to you, and they're going to ask me, rationally, logically, they're going to ask me, okay, what's his name? Now, what's his name, and what shall I say to them? Now, it's interesting. Who doesn't know God's name? Is it Moses who doesn't know his name, or is it the people of Israel who don't know his name? It's interesting, as the passage unfolds, Israel never asks him what was his name. Maybe it was Moses who didn't know his name. Because they're going to ask me your name. They know your name, but I don't know your name, and they're going to ask, and I'm going to need to know it. Can you cough it up a little bit here? You know? If I don't, I'm going to be really sus. I mean, it's going to be really bad, right? Hey, I need to know your name. So, God, so in verse 14, God said to Moses, I am who I am. You guys, it's not a noun. It's not a name. It's a verb. It is the verb to be. Hayah. Yeah, it's really easy to say Yaha, so I keep getting it messed up, but it's Hayah, the verb to be. In the uniqueness of Hebrew grammar, it could mean all sorts of things, but it really means these sorts of things. I am, I was, I will be, I am that I am. And he's talking about his presence, and so it is the I am of the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I am there. And really, it means I will be with you, in a sense. I will be with you back then. I will be with you today. I will be with you tomorrow and forever. It is the personal presence of God in our everyday lives, is what he's saying. So we have Elohim, who is the creator of the universe. And we have Yahweh, who is the sovereign God over Israel. And now he says, you tell them, I am who I am, the one who has always been, the one who will always be, the one who is today. I will be with you, every one of you, individually. Isn't that the God that the Bible presents? A God of all creation, a God who is sovereign over the nation, and the God who will be with you and will be with me in the midst of all the pain and suffering and disappointment. And heartache, and tension, and joys. But in the midst of life, I will be with you. I am that I am. I am dependent on nobody and nothing. I choose to be with you. I choose it. There are no conditions. I choose it. There is a God of strength, but a great compassion. He is so personal. Look at that, verse 14. God says to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am. Hayah has sent me to you, the one who is. Wow. And God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord Elohim, the God Yahweh the Lord Yahweh, the God Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, the Elohim of Jacob, has sent me to you. The powerful God has sent me to you to be personal with you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. You guys, we live in a generation, we live in a culture that has dismissed God, has demeaned God, demoted God, degraded God. That's the culture we live in. And so often it's what we do. We dismiss him. Think, I don't know. But you guys, it is the God Elohim who is a powerful God who created all of this. It is the God Yahweh who is sovereign over his people. It is the God Hayah to be with us. To be with us. Wow. Now, quickly, I'm going to do the New Testament section in a sense. So let's go to I am the way, the truth, and the life. Let's just do it. And let me set it up a little bit here in verse chapter 13. It says in verse 31, when he had gone out, the he he's referring to here is Judas Iscariot. Judas has just left the room to, and this is on the last night of Jesus' life. This is in the upper room. They're having supper together, the Last Supper. And we find here that Judas has left the room to go and betray Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. And it says that when he had gone out, Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified and God is glorified in him. Wow. This is, I mean, he's getting betrayed. And he's now the glorification is going to happen. Ooh. Verse 32, if God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him at once. God the Son and God the Father are glorifying each other in this process. And then, verse 33, little children, yet a little while I am with you. You will seek me, and just as I said to the Jews, so now I also say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. This had to be a bit upsetting, a bit confusing. They knew something special was happening, something unique was happening, but it seems to be kind of unraveling in front of them. And he says, I'm going someplace and you guys can't come. Whoa, okay. What do you mean? What's going on here, Jesus? And then he says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. Whatever's going to happen after this, there's still one thing I'm asking you to do. I want you to love each other. Just as I've loved you, I want you to love one another. Verse 35, by this all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. The remaining description and definition of what it means to be my people, my disciple, my follower, my surrendered follower, is to really love like I have loved you. You guys, what an incredible command, right? I mean, that just sends us both to the highest of heights and, frankly, to the lowest of lows, because we know how far we fall short. But we know there's this incredible thing that he's called us to. I call you to love one another. And by this, everyone will know who you are. So then Simon Peter gets involved. Simon Peter says to him, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus answered, a rational question. Like, okay, you say you're going someplace and we can't go with you? Where are you going? I love this about Peter. He's pretty right there. And he says, Jesus answers him and says, where I'm going, you cannot follow me now. You can't follow me yet, but you will follow afterward. And so Peter says to him, Lord, why can't I follow you now? Why can't I go right now? Jesus, I'm going to lay down my whole life for you. I know something's unfolding here that's not good, but I'm going to lay down my life for you. And Jesus answered and he said, will you lay down your life for me? Truly I say to you, ooh, this is one of the most painful statements in human history. And he says, truly, truly, I say to you, the rooster will not crow until you have denied me three times, Peter. I'm sure Peter was a bit confused. Like, what are you talking about? I'm going to die for you. But as the next several hours unfolded, he did. He denied him three times. Wow. So then it jumps into chapter 4. This is the setup, right? So here's the deal. So right on top of that, Jesus says, let not your hearts be troubled. I mean, if I'm Peter, I'm saying, are you kidding me? You just told me I'm going to deny you. I'm going to betray you just like Judas is. I'm going to do the same thing. Are you kidding? And Jesus says, let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. So he's starting to describe where he's going, right? And now he's starting to talk about it. Here we are. The Father's house, there are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? If it's not true, here's my Father's house. I have a lot of places. I'm going to prepare it for you. And then verse 3, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, and where I am, you may be also. I'm going to prepare a place. That's where I'm going. You can't go right now, but I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if it wasn't true, I wouldn't say it. Wow. Verse 4, and you know the way where I'm going. You know the way. Now, I love this part because I'm just so much like Thomas. So Thomas, the apostle, the disciple, we call him Doubting Thomas because he's like wondering all the time. He says, logically, Lord, we don't know where you're going. Just so you, I know maybe everybody else in the room knows. You know, he's looking around. But actually, he uses the plural we don't actually know where you're going. Because they're trying to figure it out, right? How can we know the way? Not only do we not know where you're going, we don't know how to get there. Are you going south towards Bethlehem? Are you going, you know, east towards Jericho? Are you going west towards the coast? Are you going north towards Nazareth? Where are you going? But if we don't know where you're going, we don't know what road to take. We don't know what's going on here. And then Jesus says to him, and I'm not sure they got it yet. I'm not sure they didn't. But Jesus says, actually, I am the way. This way to the Father, this way to his house, this place that I'm going to prepare a place for you, I am the way. It's a relationship with me. It's being with me. I personally am this. What he's really saying when he says I am, he's saying, I am not only Elohim, the one who created the world. And I am not just Yahweh, the one who is a sovereign God over all my people, but I am the one who will be with you. And you being with me is the way. So wherever you might go, I am that. I am the way. And not only on that way, but I am the truth on that way. I am the reality of that way. I am the one who fulfills that way. And I am life itself. You guys, I don't know about you, but isn't that one of the questions that we're asking in our own lives? What is this all about? Where should I walk? What direction should I go? What is really real on that path? What brings real life? We try to fill it up with so many things. And I'm afraid that so much of our culture is headed to a place that's really going to be such a dead-end road and so dissatisfying and so painful and so empty. And yet we will have made huge decisions that affect our lives down those roads. And Jesus says, no, I actually am the way. I actually am the truth. I actually am life itself, what it's really all about. And then he says this, a culminating statement, and no one comes to the Father except through me, because no one else actually is the way, no one else actually is the truth, and no one else actually is the life. It's very exclusive, but the exclusivity of it is what actually gives it substance, gives it meaning, gives it the fullness, and that he is the one, Haya, who wants to be with us, right? So therefore, what now? What do we do with this? What do we do with it? So therefore, what now? Let's go back to the statement. Understanding the nature and the character of God is the beginning and the understanding of life. So when we leave today, we live our lives this week, who he is, what he's like, actually gives substance to the way we live. Really. So that we don't diminish, deny, demote, degrade anything about him like our world does. It's not easy. I've got to tell you, I haven't, like, hey, every second of every day, I am so in touch with this. You kids can't believe it. That's not true. And I'm dealing with it too, trying to figure out how God fits, where he is, and what he's all about. But here's the deal. Just four thoughts. First of all, God, Elohim, is the powerful God of creation, and he created you and everybody around you. He is the God Elohim. And he did it for a purpose. He did it with uniqueness. And you look around the room, look at the uniqueness of every person here. You look at the uniqueness of spring as it's popping out of the ground. It's beautiful, isn't it? But look at this and uniqueness of every person in here. You're all exactly the same and you're all exactly different. Every one of you. No one has ever been like you before. It was God's idea. He is the powerful God of all creation. Secondly, God, Yahweh, is the sovereign Lord of his people. He is the sovereign Lord of his people. He is in charge. He is trustworthy. He is guiding. He is saying, I want to use you as a people to bless the world. Wow. Third, God, the Hayah, the present one, the being one, the one who I am that I am, I've always been and I am and I will always be. He is the God who is present in every dimension of every moment of every one of our lives. He is present. Whether we recognize it or not, he is. Wow. And then here's the last one. Jesus, being God himself, he claims I am. He actually is the way, and he is the truth of life, and he is the fullness of life. And in him, our lives find meaning and purpose and substance, because he is those things. And so this Easter season, as we walk through it, we start with him saying, I am the way and the truth and the life. And I just want you to know, Peter, I am that. I want you to know, Thomas, I am that. And following this, even Philip says, hey, just show us the Father. And he goes, man, have I been with you so long that you don't get it? If you want to see the Father, look at me. You've seen the Father if you see me. I am the way and the truth and the life. And we don't have to earn it or perform it. We can enjoy it. He is Elohim. He is Yahweh. He is Yahah, the present one for us. And I think to that, we just say, oh my God, thank you. Thank you. Right? It's about all we can do. And then we just live our lives in response to that. So we're going to sing about that. So Luke and the worship band is going to help us just to engage this very directly. Okay? So let me pray for us real quickly. Father, we try to figure out life and we try to figure out you. And the culture around us has done all sorts of things with you. And maybe best said by a pastor friend of mine in Germany, he says, we have not only forgotten God, but we have forgotten that we have forgotten God. We've dismissed you, we deny you, we degrade you, we demote you, we diminish you. It's so easy to do, but it's so foolish. Because when we become our own God and we make a mess out of life. Father, I pray that you would define us by the power that you live in us, that we might love one another the way you have loved us, and that by that we are known as your people. By a real love that is full of grace and full of truth. We need that. And we celebrate the fact that you are the way and the truth and the life.